Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This week, we're talking to Emma Blackery, a YouTube phenomenon who rose to fame by reading excerpts from 50 Shades of Grey, with each video getting hundreds of thousands of views. She's now got more than 1 million subscribers and her own record label, and she's a brilliant musician, by the way. We'll hear about how she got into music.
When I was about 8 or 9, singing, I think, what was it I sang? Oh, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston, which is a bold choice, may I say.
How she almost gave it up.
I tried to play it a few times, and then because I wasn't immediately Jimi Hendrix, I gave up with it very quickly. Like a couple months later, I was like, oh, I'm not going to play this anymore.
And how giving power to our viewers isn't always a great idea.
Silly things that were in the kitchen cupboards that I didn't have to go out and buy, and I would just put them together. And I would just eat them, including a spoonful of nutmeg, which I later found out is a really, really dangerous thing to do.
Right, let's get started. The first room I put Emma in was her bedroom in her dad's house when she first started posting videos online.
All my life I've been somebody that if I see something that I like, if I see someone doing something really, really well, I want to see if I can get the same sort of joy from doing it as I get from seeing other people doing it. I've always been someone who's sort of like, oh, I'll give that a go. Oh, I could do that. And at the time I was working as a waitress in a tiny little cafe in a department store, and I would come home every night, and YouTube had really just started becoming a thing for people. Like vloggers were just sort of making a name for themselves, and I was watching certain people who were really big back in the day, and they would really sort of distract me from, you know, the stress of the day, you know, rude customers and everything. I'd come home and I'd look forward to just coming home and watching them and laughing at what they were saying and relating to what they were doing. And I just thought one day, like, you know what, I want to give this a go. It wasn't even necessarily to try and escape waitressing, although I'm fortunate that I was able to, because it really didn't suit me very well at all. Hospitality is, funnily enough, not my thing. It wasn't so much to sort of get away from that. I didn't have any plans on doing it full time myself. I just wanted it to be like a new hobby of mine. I was thought, like, if I managed to get 100 subscribers, like I'd peaked, I'd be happy, you know? I basically just started out by doing that. I found out what camera some of my favorite vloggers were using. And I took a risk and I put that on a credit card, the credit card that I thought, I'm never going to be able to pay this off. I'm never going to be able to pay off 600 quid, not on waitress's wage. And it took a little while. And then things just started to get bigger and better. I stumbled across a book that was very well known at the time, which was it was by E.L. James, called 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
It was a very topical book at the time, and everyone was talking about it. And I'd seen another creator who, a few years before that, was reading Twilight, which was another book that sort of captured everyone's imaginations a few years before that. And I thought, well, why don't I apply what this creator did, but to this book that everyone's talking about? It wasn't so much a fluke, because I was hoping that people would talk about it, but the success of that series really changed everything for me. I went from having like 200 views to about 100,000 views a video.
Yeah. Were you making it for yourself then, really? You weren't really kind of, you had to do something creatively, because music, and we can talk about the music later on, but music was really what the main thrust of what you want to do with your life. So, but this kind of, the vlogging just took over. I just wondered, was there a moment you were sitting going, what? What is happening? What is happening? Look at the views I'm getting. Look at the interaction I'm getting.
There definitely was. I definitely started making it more for myself, and I was sharing it with like my friends on Facebook, you know, like I'd be happy if like 10 of my friends watched my video. When I started doing the 50 Shades of Grey series, and those numbers just started to accumulate overnight, you know, it wasn't being covered in like news articles or anything like that. I think people were just literally typing in 50 Shades of Grey on YouTube. I accidentally stumbled across something, a really good formula. And then like overnight, the videos just started getting like 10,000, 15,000. And I couldn't believe it. Those numbers blew my mind. it was really like, I think I got about 20 episodes into the series before the publishers started to get very angry at me.
this is great.
Which I can talk about if you like. They didn't like that I was reading it word for word without any sort of creative, embellishment or anything. And I, on top of that, which was saving people a lot of money on audiobooks, I was also insulting the content horrendously because it's a horrendous book. In my opinion. But there was definitely like an oh my god kind of moment, I think, when things just started to double and triple in size.
You've kind of built on that because one of the biggest problems, somebody at my age, if you try to get anything done on television or anything, you had to go to commissioning editors and everything. And suddenly YouTube came along and everybody said, no, well, hang on, we can bypass that. Building that audience then, you obviously tapped into, because that's what TV and filmmakers want to do, is what is the thing? And you obviously tapped into that. Did you do that accidentally, or did you just feel that you had a generational thing in your head?
It definitely felt accidental to me. I just wanted to create a series that I really enjoyed and was making videos that were like the videos of the people that I was watching. But there was definitely no sort of like, I want to work in TV, I want to build up this personality thing. It literally just naturally developed. And there is something to be said for, the fact that, commissioning editors and things can be bypassed and everyone has a platform now. But I think ultimately that's definitely got its good sides in terms of education and inspiration and entertainment. It's also got its downsides, I think. I don't think everyone should be restricted, but when everyone's got this level playing field and not everyone has the best of intentions, they sort of think, well, how can I get rich quick? YouTubers are all millionaires. How can I cash in on that? Which is a completely false narrative, I must say. I think there needs to be some sort of balance put in, but you can't put that in now.
But you connected, and also the comedy is brilliant. I was peeing myself. I was wetting myself.
I'm so sorry.
Well, you're to blame. I'm at that age anyway, Emma. All right. But if tampon commercials were honest.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God.
Just amazing.
Mega Ultra Jumbo Maxi Plus Comfort Pads and Tampons. Your life as a woman will be transformed so that you can continue with your everyday activities without any discomfort.
This is not comfortable! This is not comfortable!
It certainly hit that one. It really did.
Yeah, and it went viral because, and this is what I think is brilliant about you, is it's real. It's real and it's irreverent, but it's actually blowing up that myth of the things that we see on the telly.
Educational as well, right? Educational. It's not blue in colour. And it'll be, you need to go to your doctor if it is. It's not change. But yeah, that was an idea that I just came up with one day. I just wanted to sort of delve more into sketch comedy. I think the thumbnail of the video was definitely something that drew people's attention. And that was premeditated. But yeah, overall, I think those adverts are silly. So I thought, why not just have a bit of fun with it? Just have a laugh with it.
If websites started dating again, and slightly longer as well, they were like 3 minutes long, some of them. And what's really good is, I don't know where you developed this, but you've got a real innate sense of pace in the sketches with the cuts and everything between. Where did you learn that, or was that just instinctive?
I would say, honestly, I would say that's probably quite instinctive. I think it's just years of watching comedy growing up. I wasn't like this massive like comedy fanatic, but when I'd sit there at home with my dad over dinner, we'd watch all sorts of programs like just Only Fools and Horses and things like that growing up. And I think that naturally developed. I don't think I really learned that from other vloggers. I think there are some vloggers that really don't have their timing right. But I think it was just more of a natural thing, the timing. So I'm glad that's a good thing. I'm glad I have some natural innate skill.
Well, I was thinking, and I don't know if you remember the Fast Show, which was really.
I did. Yes, I grew up on the Fast Show. Yeah, tight, Shooting tight Stars, edits. The Fast Show, yeah. Harry Enfield and Chums, yeah. All of that. That was my era. I was probably borderline a bit too young for it, I'll be honest. but my parents loved it. They loved BBC Two at night. So it was always about that. And we loved it. I absolutely loved it growing up. Maybe it's the Fast Show. Maybe it's the White House. We need to blame for all of this.
We'll move on to another room in a second. But I just wanted to go down this road with you. Because you've engaged with your audience so really well, they set you challenges for the kitchen dares.
They certainly do. They like to torture me. The kitchen dares series started by a complete accident. I think I had I can't remember what the idea was now, but I had an original idea for that video at my dad's house, and I think I made some sort of error with my recording. I think like I filmed this great big elaborate thing and my memory card corrupted, I'm pretty sure, and all the footage was gone. I spent like an hour and a half, 2 hours, because you know videos that are 5 minutes in length don't take 5 minutes to make. I spent like a good couple of hours making it, and then when I went to go and edit it, all the footage was gone. And at the time, I was really trying to build up this schedule of like, I want to do like two videos a week, so I needed to have something out. So I panicked and I thought, oh, I need to improvise. So I came up with just coming up with silly things that were in the kitchen cupboards that I didn't have to go out and buy, and I would just put them together. And I would just eat them, including a spoonful of nutmeg, which I later found out is a really, really dangerous thing to do. Apparently that stuff is very toxic, but I didn't know that at the time. But everyone was doing the cinnamon challenge at the time and we didn't have any cinnamon. So I thought, oh, just nutmeg. I didn't hallucinate, thank goodness. Again, the things you learn years later. But the series became quite popular. It took off and people just wanted more and more of them. I'm now on Kitchen Dares 5. And I think the first one, like I came up with myself, like everything that I was going to eat, I just found silly things in the cupboard. And then it became like a thing where people would leave comments going, oh, I want you to try this and this and try this with this. And now it's an ongoing series where people try to come up with the most heinous collaborations.
Mind you, you're your own worst enemy, because you when they don't give
I'm
you
the one, I'm when, the one that does
really
it
bad
I'm,
ones yeah
I'm they, the idiot I'm the idiot that you
bad ones
yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, you know, I have learned over time as I've got older, because I've been doing this for a long time now. There was a point where I used to go through my suggestions and choose some of the most disgusting ones, because the more extreme you are, the more views you get. Turns out that doesn't actually correlate like that, and you don't actually have to put yourself through absolute hell. So as I'm now 28, I'm a bit wiser. Now I choose ones
education.
That aren't... Oh, I know, I'm still young and naive, but I've certainly stopped choosing the most disgusting ones. When melted chocolate and rice is the most tame. When that's tame, you know that your subscribers, I love them dearly, but they have got problems. The things they have made me eat, like hot dog water straight out the jar, it's you know...
Don't.
That's what I did when I drank it.
Let's go to your classroom. Tell me what kind of student you were, and any kind of influences, teacher-wise and everything.
I would say I don't know how I would have described myself at the time, but I would say looking back now as the person that I am and grown to be now, I was a bit precocious, a bit of a know-it-all, smart ass. I was a very sort of educated, intelligent person. Like, I got really good grades. I was very, very good at things like English language, so like the writing side of things, and math I wasn't too bad at. And I'd get mostly like A's, A stars, A's. But the problem with that is I wasn't humble with it. I very much knew that I was helping to bring the grade up at a school such as mine.
Oh my goodness.
I very much ran with it. So I would cause trouble. Me and my best friend, Lisa, we weren't always the most well-behaved. But I kind of had this air of like, well, they can't suspend me. I'm the smart ass, which was a terrible, terrible attitude. And I feel so sorry for the teachers that had to put up with me. I had some fantastic teachers. I had some very patient ones. I had some very rightfully annoyed ones, you know, who I used to think were my worst enemy. Like, I'm Dennis the Menace or something, you know. But really, they were just adults who are now, you know, who were my age now, just trying to put up with me. So it was overall a mixed bag for me at school. I didn't have a lot of friends. I think my attitude was a bit strange, and I smelled a bit funny as well. Back then, okay. I didn't take care of my hygiene very much. I'll be honest. You know, I can say it now. It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm less embarrassed by it now because I was just a smelly kid. I didn't have too many friends, but the ones that I did have, you know, I was very close with, and they kind of made it kind of worthwhile to me. I wouldn't say bullied, but I was very much sort of, I was aware that I was kind of on my own for quite a lot of it. But like I said, there were some teachers that made it kind of enjoyable sometimes. But.
Oh, what about the music? Did that start, in school? Were your folks musical?
No, basically I didn't have any sort of musical upbringing. What happened was I always loved music. I loved music more than my parents did. I connected with it more than my parents did. My parents are not musical at all. Although don't let them hear this because they'll be very upset. They can't sing. They cannot sing. They can't play instruments. It wasn't a musical family. I grew up listening to Michael Jackson and Madonna, and then the Spice Girls when I got to that age. But I got into rock music when I was 12 or 13. I became that angsty, angry teenager who liked Green Day. So my dad bought me my first guitar when I was 12, which I'm sure he later regretted. But he bought me a guitar and an amp, and I tried to play it a few times. And then because I wasn't immediately Jimi Hendrix, I gave up with it very quickly. Like a couple months later, I was like, oh, I'm not going to play this anymore. Back in like corner of the room, you know, another wasted sort of present. And when I got into school, we had music lessons, but my school was not, it wasn't a music focused school at all. I don't think the teachers knew how to really do anything. And that's not their fault. But the school was very, very underfunded when it came to the arts at our school. Like we had one piano that was not tuned at all. It was horrendous. The sort of canvas front of it was all ripped and terrible. There weren't a lot of instruments, and it didn't encourage me to want to pursue music from an educational standpoint at all. I didn't feel like for the years that we were all forced to do music, I didn't get any benefit from it. So I didn't choose it at GCSE. That was just purely my own choice. I got back into playing acoustic guitar by myself, but I didn't feel like school was going to bring any benefit to me. And then I went to college, and I was given that opportunity to study music tech and all that. But by that point, I was convinced I was going to go down the academic road, and that music was just going to be a hobby, really.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now it's not.
Because one of the things that comes out, not just from your vlogging, but also from your music, there is a confidence there. Where does that come from? Where does your confidence come from, Emma? Because you were saying earlier on, you've always been, shall I say, a bit cocky. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think I prefer the term self-assured.
We could put that in the edit.
Would you say that you were self-assured? I was a confident, self-assured individual. Yes. Thank you. I was a cocky old cow. But basically, I always really, really enjoyed singing, even from a young age, but I never, and I think this is okay to admit. I think my family would agree. I didn't have like a lot of encouragement to pursue music when I was younger. Like, I think one year I recorded myself on a camcorder when I was about 8 or 9 singing, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston, which is a bold choice, may I say, for anyone, especially a 9-year-old. Probably didn't do the best job, but I recorded myself, and then I ran downstairs and said, Dad, I just recorded a cover. I just did a cover of Whitney Houston. And he said, yeah, I heard it through the floorboards. You sound like an angel chewing on broken glass, which was quite, you know, hilarious now, but quite sad at the time. Yeah. So I didn't really have any sort of encouragement from other people, to do music. I didn't really have anyone telling me that I was doing a good job or a bad job when it came to like playing guitar or you know, or singing, because I didn't really talk to a lot of people when I was younger. So I knew it was something that I enjoyed, and because I didn't get any sort of encouragement from others, I found it in myself, you know. Right. I became my own best friend when it came to that. I was like, you know what, I'm happy with that. I'm really proud of myself that I wrote this. And I sort of stopped seeking validation from other people. Like I stopped showing, you know, music to my friends or my family, you know, because they weren't really interested. So it became very much more of a for me kind of thing when I was.
That's a really interesting point as well, Emma, because that's what I get from the vlogging as well, is because you're not bothered. And I think that's why a lot of people, probably of your age and maybe an older, have just gone, you know, all right, just do what you want to do. You'll find an audience that way. Let me take you out of the classroom for a second. And let's go for, because I can't make my mind up which room to put you into, either music writing, recording room, or studios, or writing room. Let me go, let's just talk about your music, because I've been listening to it all day, and you've been blowing my socks off. There's big anthems, but also there's a tongue-in-cheekness as well. I've been listening to, you know, the Promise. It sucks to be you is...
Sucks just, to you. I knew you were going to say sucks to you when you said sort of tongue in cheek.
Just, yeah. Tell my friends that you want to make amends, but I don't have time for that. So I guess that it sucks to be you. And you go and make the pitch that your ex-girlfriend's a bitch. And I'll happily take the hit. Because I guess that it sucks. I guess that it sucks to be you. Because when you're vlogging, you're honest, and I think your music's honest as well. So let's go down that road about your writing of your tunes. Where does that come from? Do you go with a theme? Because I love to find out how artists do it. What triggers a song for you then?
That's the thing. I mean, every single artist will have a different writing method. And there have been times where people say, like, they say to me, like, oh, how did you write this? And I'm just like, oh, I don't know. I started humming a thing in the car and it came to me like that. Other times something will happen to me and I'll be, you know, mildly peeved or slightly irked by it. And, I feel like I'm not always the best at conveying myself when I come across just trying to talk one-on-one with people. With video editing, you can sort of cut things and redo them. But I'm not always the best at sort of conveying myself emotionally. But with music, I try to channel everything into that. I try to get everything that I need to say into like 3 or 4 minutes. And I would say like a vast majority of my music, it does stem from like a memory or a feeling that I'm currently going through. And I like to think that's how I live my life. Like my videos, I try to make as genuine as possible. As genuine as someone standing in front of a camera and saying these things to a camera can be. With music, I try to make, because I've built so much of a career on being personable with people and being upfront and honest, I think it's extremely important that I stay honest about my feelings and say like, well, this song's about this. This song's about a breakup. This song's about someone that was really mean to me. I wrote my debut album based around some people, fellow influencers really from the same sort of creative melting pot who, you know, they'd be a bit like rude online, you know, they'd be a bit mean on social media now and again, because not everyone gets on, especially in a world of egos, you know. I would say that they do stem from personal experiences most of the time, or sometimes I'll tell other people's stories as well. But mostly it's from my heart.
The reason, because I've been looking at some concert footage as well, and of course you get people singing along. They just know that they know it, and you get such a wide support. Is your songwriting process, is that what you instinctively feel comfortable doing? Is it easy for you or is it hard?
Honestly, it's gone through peaks and troughs for me. Sometimes I've found songwriting really easy. For instance, my debut album, the songs and track list came together quite quickly for me because I was going through quite an intense period of feeling like I didn't have a lot of friends. Other times, sometimes I sort of drag myself into the studio and go, right, come on, it's been a while since you've had a surge of you know, creativity. You can sort of sense when you're going through a sort of writer's block, and you try and force yourself to write something, and sometimes it'll work, but other times not so much, you know. Other times it can go horrendously. It's it's not something that I inherently find easy or hard. I think ultimately it happens naturally when it's meant to happen. Some people can write 200 songs a week. You know, I can't do that.
I'm trying to. What I was trying to maybe get there, Emma, in a sort of big-footed way, was: is a songwriter? Is that what you are? Then do you think yourself the vlogging and everything else is really just a kind of a mechanism to get to songwriting?
I used to think that. I used to really desperately try and put myself in one of the boxes, you know, when my vlogging was doing better than my music. I used to be quite bitter about it and go, no, I'm a musician, not a YouTuber. I'm a musician, which is very, you know, I was a lot younger and I was feeling quite jaded. And there have been times where, you know, I would be annoyed when people were like, oh, she's a musician, or she's a vlogger, or she's this. And now I'm very much accepting that, you know, I am a multifaceted person. I'm creative in many different like avenues and channels, and they all work together. They're not meant to work against each other. I shouldn't be putting myself in these boxes of, oh, I'm this, now I'm this, or I'm not this, I'm this. They work together. You know, they work together to build a community of people who are interested in me as a person. And I'm very fortunate that is the case after like 8 years, you know, to be able to span people's lives over 8 years when people, you know, might have first watched me when they were 13 and now they're 21, to still be able to, you know, be something that's important to those people through that pivotal time in their life. It's amazing.
Sure.
So now I use everything, you know.
I'd like to take you into a big room now, because I kind of spent so long talking about the writing room, and because I love, again, find out how you do it. The big rooms. You've talked to a room full of YouTubers or influencers, because you are an influencer. You were voted, what was it, one of the 30, under 30, who most influencers in the world or something? Was that right?
Quite an achievement once, yeah. I was in the 30 under 30. I think it was like, I can't remember if it was LUK or Cosmo UK.
Yeah, it was L.
That was a surprise. I wasn't told that was going to be a thing. They don't really give you a heads up for it. I was like, oh my God. You know, that was another sort of oh my God moment. But yeah, it really sort of, made me feel like I've made a massive impact.
What about that thing? Because you've toured as well, you've filled halls as well as you've gone along. That moving into the big room, how big a shout was that, coming out of the bedroom into the big room?
It was pretty mad. My first ever headline tour. It finished in O2 Islington, which I think is like a capacity of like just over 800 people. I think I was booked originally to play Islington 2, which is the room underneath that, so that's got a lower capacity of people. I think that's got like 400-500 capacity, and then that sold out so quickly that the promoters were like, right, we're going to upgrade you, and then that sold out as well, and that was my first ever headline tour. Before that, I'd only done a few shows with other people. I'd sort of co-headline slash, you know, do like other sort of events with YouTube and things like that, like Summer in the City, which is a UK YouTube event. So that was very, very strange. It was a very surreal moment playing to 800 people who have come to see me for my name and not just like this conglomerate sort of thing. And it was very, very, very odd. And then it just sort of got bigger from there. I played Shepherd's Bush. I played Coco on my last tour, which is 1500, I think. I was fortunate enough to be part of the Busted reunion tour, where the first terrifying, one of the most fulfilling, wonderful like times of my life. It flew by, you know, for the fact that you're doing the same thing every night, just in different parts of the country for a month. It went by in what felt like a week, you know. But the first show was at Wembley Arena, which had sold out, so it was almost 15,000 people. I wasn't so much of a religious person back then at all, but I prayed before I went on, because I was just like, this is bigger than anything I've ever done in my life. It's hard to even have any expectation of how that's going to go when you have nothing to really you know, compare it to in a fair way, like comparing a room of 800 people who are all there to see you because they know you to 15,000 people who are there for someone on after you. And they're sort of, you're there while they're waiting for these other people. It was, but you know what? It wasn't as terrifying as I thought it was going to be. And I was very fortunate with that, that tour especially, because it very much sort of removed a lot of nerves that I had had before going on stage before that. Because now if I get a little bit nervous, like, oh God, go on in like half an hour, oh God, showtime in half an hour. I'm like, hang on, I played to 15,000 people who did not know who I was, were not there for me, and I survived it. It can't be scarier than that.
You seem that kind of person, you know, dive in and see how it goes. You know, of course, because people have been watching you for so long, you will have influenced people to be the next Emma, won't they? There'll be people going, oh, well, I could do an interview like this. Oh, well, I won't be around in 10 years' time. I'm Scottish.
Oh, God.
Well, yeah, don't worry. It's not your fault, Emma.
What can I do?
No, it's not that.
I want to stop this.
I run out of questions, Emma. I just run out of questions.
There will be people listening and thinking, and they will mention you. What was your influences? And that must be brilliant. Must be a great feeling, eh?
It's a very, very strange, surreal feeling. It's extremely flattering. I used to be very scared by it because, you know, you see some heroes and people who are put on pedestals and you see them perhaps like make mistakes or fall from grace. And I used to have it when people would ask me to write my song lyrics on a piece of paper so that they could then get it tattooed onto their skin. I would always go to them like, are you sure? I'm not going to say no to you because I don't need to get upset, but I need you to take this piece of paper with you and not do anything for a month. And I would make them promise that they wouldn't get it tattooed for a month at least, because I was like, this is big, this is on your skin, this is gonna be there forever, and my handwriting is bloody terrible, and that's gonna be you're gonna have to look at that, you know, it is an illegible mess, you know. but you know, basically when anyone says to me, you know, thanks to you I've worked out what I wanted to do with my life, or you know, thanks to you, you know, I've started taking steps to become a musician. I didn't get that opportunity to say that to the people who inspired me when I was growing up, you know, yeah. Like, you know, influences that made me start picking up guitar and things like that, or, you know, singer-songwriters that I still look up to now. Like I look up to Hayley Williams and Paramore. I look up to Taylor Swift. And because they are not perhaps like on the same sort of accessible social media sphere as influencers are, you know, I don't get to say to them every day, like, you know, I'm doing it because you've inspired me to. So I don't take it for granted when people are able to say that to me and mean it, you know, like that would have meant the world to me if I could say that to the people that inspired me. So it means a lot.
Right, well, let me take you to your next room, your final room, and you've been brilliant with us. Thank you for your patience. Room of the future, right? I'm taking you into the room, all right? What will be the dream room? What will happen in that room then, the dream room?
We're time traveling. I love it.
Yes.
You magical man.
Yes.
Basically, I tweeted about this just the other day. I've had this dream. This one, like, I call it my Everest, basically. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to stop if I do it, but it's going to be very much like before this event and after this event for me in my life, if I'm able to do it. And it's basically a dream that I've had since I read an interview of one of my other favorite musicians who said that it was always their dream. And I sort of adapted it and made it become my dream because they went on to do it. And that was to headline, do a solo headline show at Brixton Academy. It's my all-time favorite venue. I've seen some of my favorite bands there. I've seen Placebo there. I've seen 21 Pilots there. I absolutely adore the venue. I think it's wonderful. I love the sloped floors because I'm only 5'2", so I can see the acts no matter where I am. You know, we need sloped floors when we're very short. I love the architecture. I love the history of the building. It's just my favorite venue, you know. And if I could do that, I said on Twitter just the other day, you know, it is my dream to do it. But if I do it, it will probably just be an hour and a half of me crying on stage. So,
yeah when you're in your dreams.
Be the most fun. but no, that would be the dream.
The last question for you then, last couple of questions. Who would you most like to be in a room with? Have a think about it. And the other one would be who's the person you'd least like to be in the room with, and you can't say me.
Oh, see, this is a trick question, isn't it? Not the last part, because I would never say that about you. No, I would never do that. We're friends now. But I feel like the first part's a trick. Am I supposed to say like Gandhi? Am I supposed to say
No, you can do whatever you like.
It's like when the genie says you've got three wishes. Am I supposed to wish for world peace? Is anyone going to be watching when I give my wishes?
That's cliche, and you're not cliche.
I am not, no. No, nobody's listening. Nobody's watching. So, as I said earlier, like some of my massive inspirations are Hayley Williams and Paramore. She's an incredibly strong woman. She's very motivated. She, you know, started making music from the age of like 14, 15, and is now an incredibly intelligent woman. She just released her first like solo album. She's gone through a lot of trials and tribulations, like controversies. She's had people leave her band, and there've been rumors about why, and she's been painted as this, you know, it must be her, it must be her problem, and she's come through it all. And her music's amazing, her voice is amazing. So she would definitely be someone that I would love to be in a room with, just to talk, just to ask her all of these questions, like, how do you do this? And I would say exactly the same for Taylor Swift as well. You know, a lot of people have this sort of like idea of like Taylor Swift fans, they're either like they're crazy, they're absolutely mental young girls, but she is an incredibly passionate, extremely talented woman. You know, she's been doing it from a young age as well, and she's been really put through the ringer with the press, and she's always come out with incredible music, and her music speaks for her. You know, no matter what people say about her, no matter what people say about, oh, she writes about this, she writes about that, oh, she's fallen out with this person, her music is incredible. And that's something that I aspire to be, you know, where the only thing she ever has to say is, this is my new album. And that's it. It says everything that she wants you to hear. So I would say those two people especially I'd like to be in a room with.
And least like to be in the room with?
Who else would I like to be in a room with?
You don't have to say. You don't have to say if it's got to...
I mean, I'm all for being shady. I don't mind. I don't mind spilling some truth.
You're a big fan of Google. You could maybe see the CEO of Google.
See, I would love to be in the room with the CEO of Google. CEO of YouTube. I would absolutely love that. There's no hate there. I would revel in it. I don't know. I would probably say, you know, throughout my time in the music industry, I've met some people, you know, and I'll only be brief about it, but like, you know, I've met some people that have, you know, wronged me. The music industry is absolutely full of it. You know, it really is. And it's not just major labels. You know, there's, you know, it starts from, you know, the ground up. There's people who will try and take advantage of you. And I've experienced that. And there are some people I can think of who I would not like to be in the same room as again in my life. But I'm just a lot smarter and older now. And now I would not be in that room. I would make sure I'm
And you've got your own label.
I do, yeah, exactly. I run my own label, so that's a good feeling. You know, I've spent the last year trying to really take more control over my music. I was using various distributors. With every new release, I was signing with a new distributor. You know, and this year, my partner's really helped me to really take more control back as well. Like we worked really hard together to just like get that control back and be like, no, I'm taking this back now. I'm redistributing this through my own label. You're not going to take 20% cut for doing nothing or just uploading something for me 5 years ago. So I've been going through old contracts and just trying to take back that control. So it's a good feeling.
Big thanks to Emma Blackery. Next week, we'll be talking to the former leader of the Green Party and member of the House of Lords, Baroness Natalie Bennett, about her time leading the party and a whole lot more.
The practical reality of that day was I'd had 3.5 hours sleep and had been throwing up most of the previous night. And my key mistake that day was I should have just pulled from everything.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time in the room.